Perhaps we could talk a little bit about the idea of balance. I think that came out of what Jack Rabanne said, this idea that there is something out there called nature which is naturally balanced, which is a kind of in a self-regulating equilibrium against which we humans shouldn't interfere. And it seems to me that what you're saying, both here and elsewhere, is that it's precisely because we do interfere that we need to interfere again.
Yes, that's a very nice formula. I agree, yes.
Because talk a little bit about the idea of balance and this idea of secular, ecology as a kind of secular.
I've written about it, so I don't like that. I said that's the main point on which I insist. If we, this is the reason why I think that a task of me as a kind of intellectual is not so much to provide answers, like what to do, my God, what do I know what to do, but to correct the questions. What we intellectuals can do is to show how the very way we define a problem, which is for this reason no less a real problem, the very way we perceive a problem, instead of effectively resolving the problem, can be part of the problem. Let me put you just two other examples so that you will get clearly the logic, examples that I repeat all the time. That's why I'm so opposed to the notion of tolerance. It doesn't mean I'm for intolerance, my God. Of course, I know there is racist intolerance, ethnic intolerance, sexual intolerance, again. But, you know, it's not self-evident that what we call racism has automatically to be perceived in the terms of tolerance. My old example, which I think already repeated here, take Martin Luther King. He never, even, I think, uses the word tolerance. It's a very precise reason why today we automatically translate it into tolerance. Because we live, again, in a post-political society where the only conflicts you can imagine are this kind of religious lifestyle conflicts, and then, of course, all you can, or again, ecology would have been a nice example here. Of course, it's a radical topic. I mean, topic of radical danger. But nonetheless, the way we perceive it, all this, as you put it, secularized religious stuff of some natural balance destroyed and now returned to balance, this should be, I think, radically abandoned. That is to say, I'm simply here not following some general Marxist Hegelian line, but even the line of those Darwinist biologists that I respect, like Stephen Jay Gould and so on, who point out that nature in itself is not natural, if I may put it in this way. Mm-hmm. Nature in itself is one big confusion and chaos. My eternal example, just imagine what a catastrophe must have happened on Earth for us to have oil. I mean, can we even imagine such a catastrophe? This doesn't make solution any easier. This doesn't mean, oh, there is no natural balance, so we can do whatever we want. No, it's even more tragic. It means we don't have any natural standard to which we can return. We are in the open, in an abyss. And the second thing, here I follow Ulrich Beck with Risk Society and so on, we are becoming aware how also in nature the process is possibly radically open and contingent. It's precisely because we are, how should I put it, part of the problem, our activity, that precisely, if you put it, as I already mentioned there, the result of the becoming scientific of our daily lives is that science itself functions in its own eyes. Did you notice this? More and more, and please believe me, I don't mean this in that shitty postmodern sense, oh, we are just stories that we are telling ourselves about ourselves, and science is just another story. No, but nonetheless, I notice how not only in, it's not only in ecology, where, again, I'm always here to blame the big companies. But, you know, it's not as simple as we know the truth, just some tobacco or oil companies are bribing scientists and so on. I think we genuinely don't know. The very good scientists, I met some of them in the United States about ecology, they are very dialectical, even in a very naive sense, not even Hegelian. For example, every intelligent scientist on ecology, on balance, will point out to you that One of the main results of global warming will be, and here at least, that jerk, I can use the words like this, Roland Emmerich was right in the day after tomorrow, that one of the effects of global warming will be probably much more cold in some parts of the world. And so this uncertainty, because it's not only ecology. Take even, for example, quantum physics, quantum cosmology, and so on. My God, it's almost anything that is possible. You know, there are some people who advocate one Big Bang. There are some people who advocate multiple Big Bangs. There are some people who advocate, like Stephen Jay Hawking, that Big Bang is just a perspective illusion if you apply the wrong notion linear of time. If you apply what Stephen Hawking calls imaginary time, nothing to do with imagination, just time have to calculate it with imaginary, the square of minus one number, then it's more circular, you don't need the Big Bang, and so on and so on. So just, I think we have to become aware of this, and I like this paradox. So the paradox of becoming scientific of our world is that paradoxically, and I love this, this is maybe my primitive Hegelian side, the main lesson is that precisely for the ultimate decision what to do, we cannot rely on science. Not in this simple normative way, you know, science gives you only facts, but values should come from God or from deep in your heart and so on. No, it's not as simple as that. It's that simply you get multiplicity from sciences, and these multiplicities are real, authentic. Again, I'm not saying it's just
there's a certainty that people are looking for is fact. So when people read those books purporting to tell them how to run their sex lives because they're kind of on the basis of natural science, they're looking really for suggestion, they're looking for uncertainty, but they don't really find it. Is that
no, this is obvious, of course, because no, with sexuality it's especially a nice case, I think, because okay, this is now my commentary, not sacrilegious. Here I'm ready even to do something sacrilegious and criticize Hegel himself. You know what's for me the problem with sexuality? Is that even Hegel succumbs to this simplistic vision of you have something called natural sex, not in any idealized sense of higher balance, but simply, you know, as we put it, animals know when to copulate. You know, you do it when there is the mating season, then you don't do it, and so on and so on. While with us humans, nice, again, dialectic paradox. A, we don't know how to do it, we need all the bullshit of literature, needs manuals, and so on. But at the same time, the price of this less is a more. Precisely because sexuality is failed, everything can become sexual. Like, maybe I am here, what my New Age fundamentalist fanatics like to call a victim of speciesism, you know, that even worse than racism. Elevating species to but nonetheless, I think that, for example, take those animals who know how to do, I don't know, some stupid whatever, porks or pigs or whatever. They know when to copulate. But I doubt that when for example, a cow grazes grass together with the bull, I doubt that this eating grass can become sexualized. You see this? No, sorry. What I want to say is that what's wrong with Hegel then?
Have you noticed those wildlife documentaries? How the animals who are fucking—they all look incredibly bored.
They are because I mean this was clear even to Saint Augustine and so on. But he made it very clearly that already in paradise there was sex in the literal sense. To put it in your dirty terms. Like crazy. But as St. Augustine puts it, it wasn't eroticism proper. There was none of this passionate excess. As he puts it, getting an erection in paradise was the same as raising your hand. It was simply, to put it in Habermasian terms, a pure instrumental activity that you can do. Okay, but just you know, where Hegel's image is the following one. We have this natural sex, and then we humans sublimate, cultivate it, symbolize it. So instead of, I don't know, I see, sorry for the sexist example, I see a girl I like. Instead of jumping on her and hitting her on her head. She can do it. I write poems. I do all the things about dancing and so on. So the forum gets gradually symbolized. But I claim that Hegel should have known, following his own logic, dialectical logic, that something much more mysterious happens. And already Kant knew this. When Kant says something, you know, Immanuel Kant, he has the most wonderful definition of a human being. A human being is an animal who needs a master. Why? To control, dominate through education what Kant calls this wilderness, original, excessive wilderness of a human being. And this kind of excessive, voluntary, I want this because of this, for every, and Kant makes it very clear, this is not animality. This, what Kant calls excessive, which is why animals don't need a master. So, in other words, to apply this to sexuality, it is true that through our symbolization, writing poems, blah, 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 we try to integrate into social life, symbolize, introduce balance into something. But that something is not nature. That something is some kind of unnatural excess, neither nature nor culture. You have something in between, as it were. This, the Freudian name for this, of course, is the death drive, which is neither culture nor nature. And so I think that in this sense, this complicates things. And then, of course, we should go here to the end and ask, but is there a natural balance at all? Here we can again, I'm getting so crazy lately as to trying to rehabilitate even Hegel's philosophy of nature. And then I discover there are many in Germany who are trying to do this, pointing out that Hegel is here much more radical than it appears. For Hegel, as he puts it in some of his fragments, even the real nature, natural nature, is already second nature. The model of nature is not things go on harmoniously. The model of nature is a catastrophe, and then adaptation means you can somehow, you try to find a balance which runs for a certain time function. Then, you know, nature itself is adapting in this sense of fighting for artificial balance in kind of a radically contingent abyss and so on and so on. It's not only that. We should maybe even drop this well-known metaphor of popular, even with Hegel, but Kierkegaard later, man as nature which is death, sickness, you know, as if there is natural harmony and so on, and then man introduces imbalance. Is there an imbalance in nature at all? And again, I don't think this means that we should not take ecological crisis not seriously. We should take it much more seriously, but precisely because we should become conscious again that we don't have a big other in the sense of a standard, even if it's a lost standard. We cannot even imagine how things could have been if we were to return. There is no model.
One last quick question before I throw it open to the audience. It sounds to me like from what you're saying, that if you're saying that we need to interfere more in nature in order to solve these problems, there isn't a natural balance, then that means that you would favor a kind of geoengineering solution. So there's a quick technical fix.
No. Here I'm much more, you know, my God, nature is simply, the more we know about nature, the more we become aware how contingent and interconnected it is. You know, you do something which, you know, nature is always, as we learn more and more, even our brains, but like nature, because we put it, not in the strict Freudian sense, but nonetheless overdetermined, you know. You see this problem, you do this, but when it's too late, you discover that by solving this problem, you miss another function of this element. At a very primitive level, when I was young, you remember, when I was young, unfortunately, some of you are even older, most of you not, I remember it was popular to read Thor Heyerdahl, Kon-Tiki, he tried to move, I think, from Africa to South America. And then, you know what he did? He tried to build the exact replica on an old Egyptian on what sheet. He just didn't do something. There was between the mask, how you call it, and the back of the boat or front, I forgot, some nicely decorated rope. He said, okay, this was probably some stupid religious ritual for stupid Egyptian. He said, let's not do that. Then he paid the price. The first time he went there, like, 30 miles, something like this, from Brazilian coast, he was almost there, he discovered that this apparently only an aesthetic supplement had a precise function of holding the balance of the ship when there are waves and so on. And again, 20, 30 miles of Brazilian coast, the ship started to fall. You know, I'm not simply an activist. My point is simply that it's a much more tragic one. Here, although I was told, but I still like him, that John Gray, a day or two ago, that he wrote a rather negative review of my book, no? But nonetheless, I quote him and still will. He said something very nice, that we are forced to behave as if we are free. And this goes especially for ecology. You know, the old Marxist dogma, which I respect, is we apparently live in a free society, but in reality, our choices are limited. Like, you know, all our freedoms in bourgeois society are superficial. It's just Diet Coke or Pepsi, this or that. No, he is right to point out that the problem today is at the same time the opposite one. We are all the time bombarded by choices without, how should I put it, without being even given the proper background of knowledge of how to make a choice. This is what causes for anxiety. I really am more and more full of anxiety. My God, what shitty times to believe you cannot even reserve a hotel. You have to soft or hard pillow and so on, all that. You know, and this is maybe the crucial ideological struggle today, I claim. This is why, without any illusions about Obama, I think it's an important struggle he's fighting today about healthcare. It doesn't concern only healthcare. It concerns precisely this, let's call it, ideology of free choice. Because, again, what Americans don't seem to get is something that you can know that every Hegelian knows. That in today's societies, precisely these individual freedoms that we cherish on an extremely thick background of institutions, laws, rules, customs, even civility, and so on and so on. You take all that away, and it's the same for example, they claim, Obama wants, right-wingers, Obama wants to take from us the freedom to choose. Well, my first metaphor would have been here, look at the background. My comparison would have been, why don't we treat healthcare along the lines of electricity and water, which are also absolutely necessary for our survival, but we are, I mean this ironically. No, specifically meaning, water and electricity. Did you notice that we are, at least I think also in England, we are brutally deprived of the choice of which water or electricity provider you that, how should I put it, it can be done. Look at Norway and so on today. I'm not asking the impossible, not any socialist terror and so on, but simply that all the people we can afford it should be allowed a kind of zero level assurance. If I'm ill, if I will be ill, of course I'm afraid. But I should be afraid not of that I may not have money for an operation, but you know what I mean? Kind of, you don't have to worry about that. And I would be very glad to be deprived of this freedom of choice to worry, because I claim this opens up a much more freedom of choice to deal with more creative things. I mean, okay, it's nice to have a freedom of choice to worry about your healthcare. But you know, I wouldn't like to live worrying hours about healthcare and so on and so on. So, you know, this is ideology at work, and it's the same with ecology. But okay, let's talk.
We've got time for a couple of very quick questions. Why don't you keep your questions in the singular and very quick and relevant to some of the points that we've been discussing. If you keep it very short.
Thank you very much.
Following me.
I noticed that you say there is no big other to give us answers to things.
Yeah.
But at the same time in your book, which I've read cover to cover now, you mentioned truth with a capital T. Now, I think that in other words, you're going back on your own. There is no big other. Similarly, there's no big truth out there. Now, let me just develop this a little bit. Rorty and people like that have already come to that conclusion. And I know you oppose Rorty in certain extent. But I think that we should take the Rorty line. There is no big other. There is no truth. But at the same time, we should do something to help the excluded. In other words, we can get together on that. As for Kant's description of the human, my description of the human is an animal with delusions of not being human.
You know what? I'm almost tempted, of course, it's better for me to say, but I really mean it, to take you by your word, the first version.
Yeah.
That the animal, the human is an animal. What was
delusions of not being
enough. Was this your first version? Wasn't your first version not being human? I'm almost going to the first one. Okay, so but what I want to say, you know, it all depends. My problem with Rorty is double. I respect him very much. I don't mean this as a hypocrisy. He was one of the kindest persons that I knew, and I can tell you stories about how, for example, when he was still in Charlottesville, there were some